bald tires and telling Frenchman jokes, Jim Brooks had been in law school, knocking his brains out to make grades. Because when you made the grades, you got the diploma, and the diploma was your ticket. You got to ride the merry-go-round. Getting on didn't mean you'd catch the brass ring, no, but it guaranteed you the chance to at least try. "You go on up now and get ready for bed," she said quietly. "What you think of your Uncle Jim is between you and you. But give him a chance, Brett. Don't just judge him on that." They had gone through into the family room now, and she jerked a thumb at the jukebox. "No, I won't," he said. She followed him up into the kitchen, where Holly was making cocoa for the four of them. Jim Jr. and Gretchen had gone to bed long before. "You get your man?" Holly asked.
"No, he's probably down chewing the fat with that friend of his," Charity said. "We'll try tomorrow."
"Want some cocoa, Brett?" Holly asked.
"Yes, please."
Charity watched him sit down at the table. She saw him put his elbow on it and then take it off again quickly, remembering that it was impolite. Her heart was so full of love and hope and fear that it seemed to stagger in her chest.
"Time," she thought. "Time and perspective. Give him that. If you force him, you'll lose him for sure."
But how much time was there? Only a week, and then he would be back under Joe's influence. And even as she sat down next to her son and thanked Holly for her cup of hot cocoa, her thoughts had turned speculatively to the idea of divorce again. In her dream, Vic had come. He simply walked down the driveway to the Pinto and opened her door. He was dressed in his best suit, the three-piece charcoal gray one. When he put it on, she always teased him that he looked like Jerry Ford with hair. "Come on, you two," he said, and that quirky little grin on his face. "Time to go home before the vampires come out." She tried to warn him, to tell him the dog was rabid, but no words came. And suddenly Cujo was advancing out of the dark, his head down, a steady low growl rumbling in his chest. "Watch out!" she tried to cry. "His bite is death!" But no sound came out. But just before Cujo launched himself at Vic, he turned and pointed his finger at the dog. Cujo's fur went dead white instantly. His red, rheumy eyes dropped back into his head like marbles into a cup. His muzzle fell off and shattered against the crushed gravel of the driveway like black glass. A moment later, all that was left in front of the garage was a blowing fur coat. "Don't you worry," Vic said in the dream. "Don't you worry about that old dog. It's nothing but a fur coat. Did you get the mail yet?" "Never mind the dog. The mail's coming. The mail's the important thing, right? The mail." His voice was disappearing down a long tunnel, growing echoey and faint. And suddenly, it was not a dream of Vic's voice, but a memory of a dream. She was awake, and her cheeks were wet with tears. She had cried in her sleep. She looked at her watch and could just make out the time, 1:15. She looked over at Tad and saw he was sleeping soundly, his thumb hooked into his mouth.
"Never mind the dog. The mail's coming. The mail's the important thing."
And suddenly the significance of the package hung over the mailbox door came to her, hit her like an arrow fired up from her subconscious mind, an idea she had not quite been able to get hold of before. Perhaps because it was so big, so simple, so elementary, my dear Watson. Yesterday was Monday, and the mail had come. The J.C. Whitney package for Joe Camber was ample proof of that. Today was Tuesday, and the mail would come again.
Tears of relief began to roll down her not-yet-dry cheeks. She actually had to restrain herself from shaking Tad awake and telling him it was going to be all right, that by 2 o'clock this afternoon at the latest, and more probably by 10 or 11 in the morning, if the mail delivery out here was as prompt as it was most other places in town, this nightmare would end. The mailman would come, even if he had no mail for the Cambers. That was the beauty of it. It would be his job to see if the flag was up, signifying outgoing mail. He would have to come up here, to his last stop on Town Road Number 3, to check that out. And today, he was going to be greeted by a woman who was semi-hysterical with relief. She eyed Tad's lunchbox and thought of the food inside. She thought of herself carefully saving some of it aside in case, well, in case. Now it didn't matter so much, although Tad was likely to be hungry in the morning. She ate the rest of the cucumber slices. Tad didn't care for cucumbers much anyway. It would be an odd breakfast for him, she thought, smiling. Fig bars, olives, and a Slim Jim or two. Munching the last 2 or 3 cucumber slices, she realized it was the coincidences that had scared her the most. That series of coincidences, utterly random, but mimicking a kind of sentient fate, had been what seemed to make the dog so horribly purposeful, so out to get her personally. Vic being gone for 10 days, that was coincidence number one. Vic calling early today, that was coincidence number two. If he hadn't got them then, he would have tried later, kept trying, and begun to wonder where they were. The fact that all three of the Cambers were gone, at least for overnight, the way it looked now, that was number three. Mother, son, and father, all gone. But they had left their dog. Oh, yes, they had... A sudden horrible thought occurred to her, freezing her jaws on the last bite of cucumber. She tried to thrust it away, but it came back. It wouldn't go away because it had its own gargoyle-like logic. What if they were all dead in the barn? The image rose behind her eyes in an instant. It had the unhealthy vividness of those waking visions which sometimes come in the morning's small hours. The three bodies tumbled about like badly made toys on the floor in there, the sawdust around them stained red, their dusty eyes staring up into the blackness where barn swallows cooed and fluttered, their clothing ripped and chewed, parts of them... Oh, that's crazy. That's... Maybe he had gotten the boy first. The other two are in the kitchen, or maybe upstairs having a quickie. They hear the screams, they rush out. Stop it! Won't you stop it? They rush out, but the boy is already dead. The dog has torn his throat out. And while they're still stunned by the death of their son, the St. Bernard comes lurching out of the shadows, old and terrible engine of destruction. Yes, the old monster comes from the shadows, rabid and snarling. He goes for the woman first, and the man tries to save her. No. He would have gotten his gun, or brained it with a wrench or something, and... Where's the car? There was a car here before they all went off on a family trip. Do you hear me? Family trip. Took the car, left the truck. Then why had no one come to feed the dog? That was the logic of the thing, part of what frightened her. Why hadn't anyone come to feed the dog? Because if you were going to be away for a day or for a couple of days, you made an arrangement with somebody. They fed your dog for you, and then when they were gone, you feed their cat for them, or their fish, or their parakeet, or whatever. So where... And the dog kept going back into the barn. Was it eating in there? That's the answer, her mind told her, relieved. He didn't have anyone to feed the dog, so he poured it a tray of food, Gaines meal or something.
But then she stuck upon what Joe Camber himself had stuck upon earlier on that long, long day. A big dog would gobble it all at once and then go hungry. Surely it would be better to get a friend to feed the dog if you were going to be gone. On the other hand, maybe they had been held up. Maybe there really had been a family reunion, and Camber had gotten drunk and passed out. Maybe this, maybe that, maybe anything. Is the dog eating in the barn? What is it eating in there? Gaines' meal? Or people? She spat the last of the cucumber into her cupped hand and felt her stomach roll, wanting to send up what she had already eaten. She set her will upon keeping it down, and, because she could be very determined when she wanted to, she did keep it down. They had left the dog some food and had gone off in the car. You didn't have to be Sherlock Holmes to deduce that. The rest of it was nothing but a bad case of the willies. But that image of death kept trying to creep back in. The dominant image was the bloody sawdust, sawdust which had gone the dark color of natural casing Frank's. Stop. Think about the mail if you have to think about anything. Think about tomorrow. Think about being safe. There was a soft, scuffling, scratching noise on her side of the car. She didn't want to look, but was helpless to stop herself. Her head began to turn as if forced by invisible yet powerful hands. She could hear the low creak of the tendons in her neck. Cujo was there, looking in at her. His face was less than 6 inches from her own. Only the safety glass of the driver's side window separated them. Those red, bleary eyes stared into hers. The dog's muzzle looked as if it had been badly lathered with shaving cream that had been left to dry. Cujo was grinning at her. She felt a scream building in her chest, coming up in her throat like iron, because she could feel the dog thinking at her, telling her, "I'm going to get you, babe. I'm going to get you, kiddo. Think about the mailman all you want to. I'll kill him, too, if I have to, the way I killed all three of the Cambers, the way I'm going to kill you and your son. You might as well get used to the idea. You might as well." The scream coming up in her throat. It was a live thing struggling to get out, and everything was coming on her at once. Tad having to pee, she had unrolled his window 4 inches and held him up so he could do it out the window, watching all the time for the dog. And for a long time he hadn't been able to go, and her arms had begun to ache. Then the dream. Then the images of death. And now this. The dog was grinning in at her. He was grinning in at her. Cujo was his name, and his bite was death. The scream had to come, but Tad's, or she would go mad, sleeping. She locked her jaws against the scream the way she had locked her throat against the urge to vomit a few moments ago. She struggled with it, she fought it, and at last her heart began to slow down, and she knew she had it licked. She smiled at the dog and raised both of her middle fingers from closed fists. She held them against the glass, which was now slightly fogged on the outside with Cujo's breath. "Go get fucked," she whispered. After what seemed an endless time, the dog put its forepaws down and went back into the barn. Her mind turned down that same dark track again. What's it eating in there? And then she slammed a door shut somewhere in her mind. But there would be no more sleep, not for a long time, and it was so long until dawn.
She sat upright behind the wheel, trembling, telling herself over and over again that it was ridiculous, really ridiculous, to feel that the dog was some kind of hideous revenant which had escaped from Tad's closet, or that it knew more about the situation than she did. Vic jerked awake in total darkness, rapid breath as dry as salt in his throat. His heart was trip-hammering in his chest, and he was totally disoriented, so disoriented that for a moment he thought he was falling and reached out to clutch the bed. He closed his eyes for a moment, forcibly holding himself together, making himself coalesce. "You are in?" He opened his eyes and saw a window, a bedstand, a lamp. The Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Boston, Massachusetts. He relaxed. That reference point given, everything came together with a reassuring click, making him wonder how he could have been so lost and totally apart, even momentarily. It was being in a strange place, he supposed. That and the nightmare. Nightmare. Jesus, it had been a beaut. He couldn't remember having had such a bad one since the falling dreams that had plagued him off and on during early puberty. He reached for the travelette clock on the nightstand, gripped it in both hands, and brought it close to his face. It was 2:40. Roger was snoring lightly in the other bed, and now that his eyes had adjusted to the dark, he could see him, sleeping flat on his back. He had kicked the sheet over the end of the bed. He was wearing an absurd pair of pajamas covered with small yellow college pennants. Vic swung his legs out of bed, went quietly into the bathroom, and closed the door. Roger's cigarettes were on the washstand, and he helped himself to one. He needed it. He sat on the toilet and smoked, tapping ashes into the sink. An anxiety dream, Donna would have said, and God knew he had enough to be anxious about. Yet he had gone to bed around 10:30 in better spirits than he had been in for the last week. After arriving back at the hotel, he and Roger had spent half an hour in the Ritz-Carlton's bar, kicking the apology idea around. And then, from the bowels of the huge old wallet he hauled around, Roger produced the home number of Yancey Harrington. Harrington was the actor who played the sharp serial professor. "Might as well see if he'll do it before we go any further," Roger said. He had picked up the phone and dialed Harrington, who lived in Westport, Connecticut. Vic hadn't known just what to expect. If pressed for his best guess, he would have said that probably Harrington would have to be stroked a little. He had been just miserable over the Zingers affair and what he considered it had done to his image. Both of them had been in for a happy surprise. Harrington had agreed instantly. He recognized the realities of the situation and knew the professor was pretty well finished. "Poor old guy's a gone goose," Harrington had said glumly. But he thought the final ad might be just the thing to get the company over the affair, put it back on the rails, so to speak. "Bullshit," Roger said, grinning after he had hung up. "He just likes the idea of one final curtain call. Not many actors in advertising get a chance like that. He'd buy his own plane ticket to Boston if we asked him to." So Vic had gone to bed happy and had fallen asleep almost instantly. Then the dream. He was standing in front of Tad's closet door in the dream and telling Tad that there was nothing in there, nothing at all. "I'll show you once and for all," he told Tad. He opened the closet door and saw that Tad's clothes and toys were gone. There was a forest growing in Tad's closet, old pines and spruces, ancient hardwoods. The closet floor was covered with fragrant needles and leafy mulch. He had scraped at it, wanting to see if the floor of painted boards was beneath. It wasn't. His foot scraped up rich black forest earth instead. He stepped into the closet, and the door closed behind him. That was all right. There was enough light to see by. He found a trail and began to hike along it. All at once he realized there was a pack on his back and a canteen slung over one shoulder. He could hear the mysterious sound of the wind soughing through the firs and faint bird song. 7 years ago, long before AdWorks, they had all gone hiking on part of the Appalachian Trail during one of their vacations, and that land had looked a good deal like the geography of his dream. They had done it only that once, sticking to the seacoast after that. Vic, Donna, and Roger had had a wonderful time, but Althea Breakstone loathed hiking, and had come down with a good itchy case of poison oak on top of that. The first part of the dream had been rather pleasant. The thought that all this had been right inside Tad's closet was, in its own strange way, wonderful. Then he had come into a clearing, and he had seen... But it was already beginning to tatter, the way dreams do when they are exposed to waking thought. The other side of the clearing had been a sheer gray wall, rising maybe 1,000 feet into the sky. About 20 feet up, there was a cave. No, not really deep enough to be a cave. It was more of a niche, just a depression in the rock that happened to have a flat floor. Donna and Tad were cowering inside, cowering from some sort of monster that was trying to reach up and then reach in, get them, eat them. It had been like that scene in the original King Kong, after the great ape has shaken Fay Wray's would-be rescuers from the log and is trying to get the lone survivor. But the guy has gotten into a hole, and Kong isn't quite able to get him. The monster in his dream hadn't been a giant ape, though. It had been a... What? Dragon? No, nothing like that. Not a dragon. Not a dinosaur. Not a troll. He couldn't get it. Whatever it was, it couldn't quite get in and get Donna and Tad, so it was merely waiting outside their bolt hole, like a cat waiting with dreadful patience for a mouse. He began to run, but no matter how fast he went, he never got any closer to the other side of the clearing. He could hear Donna screaming for help, but when he called back, his words seemed to die 2 feet out of his mouth. It was Tad who had finally spotted him.
"They don't work!"
Tad had screamed in a hopeless, despairing voice that had hollowed out Vic's guts with fear.
"Daddy, the monster words don't work. Oh, Daddy, they don't work. They never worked. You lied, Daddy. You lied."
He ran on, but it was as if he were on a treadmill, and he had looked at the base of that high gray wall and had seen a heaped drift of old bones and grinning skulls, some of them furred with green moss. That was when he woke up. What had that monster been, anyway? He just couldn't remember. Already the dream seemed like a scene observed through the wrong end of a telescope. He dropped the cigarette into the john, flushed it, and ran water into the sink as well to swirl the ashes down the drain. He urinated, shut off the light, and went back to bed. As he lay down, he glanced at the telephone and felt a sudden irrational urge to call home. Irrational? That was putting it mildly. It was 2:50 in the morning. He would not only wake her up, he would probably scare the living hell out of her in the bargain. You didn't interpret dreams literally. Everyone knew that. When both your marriage and your business seemed in danger of running off the rails at the same time, it wasn't really surprising that your mind pulled a few unsettling head games, was it? Still, just to hear her voice and know she's okay. He turned away from the telephone, punched up the pillow, and resolutely shut his eyes. "Call her in the morning, if that'll make you feel better. Call her right after breakfast." That eased his mind, and very shortly he drifted off to sleep again. This time he did not dream, or, if he did, these dreams never imprinted themselves on his conscious mind. And when the wake-up call came on Tuesday, he had forgotten all about the dream of the beast in the clearing. He had only the vaguest recollection of having gotten up in the middle of the night at all. Vic did not call home that day. Charity Camber awoke that Tuesday morning on the dot of 5 and went through her own brief period of disorientation. Yellow wallpaper instead of wood walls, colorful green print curtains instead of white chintz, a narrow single bed instead of the double that had begun to sag in the middle. Then she knew where she was, Stratford, Connecticut, and felt a burst of pleased anticipation. She would have the whole day to talk to her sister, to hash over old times, to find out what she had been doing the last few years. And Holly had talked about going into Bridgeport to do some shopping. She had awakened an hour and a half before her usual time, probably 2 hours or more before things began to stir in this household. But a person never slept well in a strange bed until the third night. That had been one of her mother's sayings, and it was a true one. The silence began to give up its little sounds as she lay awake and listening, looking at the thin 5 o'clock light that fell between the half-drawn curtains. Dawn's early light, always so white and clear and fine. She heard the creak of a single board, a blue jay having its morning tantrum, the day's first commuter train bound for Westport, Greenwich, and New York City. The board creaked again. And again. It wasn't just the house settling, it was footsteps. Charity sat up in bed, the blanket and sheet pooling around the waist of her sensible pink nightgown. Now the steps were going slowly downstairs. It was a light tread, bare feet or sock feet. It was Brett. When you lived with people, you got to know the sound of their walk. It was one of those mysterious things that just happen over a course of years, like the shape of a leaf sinking into a rock. She pushed the covers back, got up, and went to the door. Her room opened on the upstairs hall, and she just saw the top of Brett's head disappearing, his cowlick sticking up for a moment, and then gone. She went after him. When Charity reached the top of the stairs, Brett was just disappearing down the hallway that ran the width of the house, from the front door to the kitchen. She opened her mouth to call him, and then shut it again. She was intimidated by the sleeping house that wasn't her house. Something about the way he had been walking, the set of his body, but it had been years since... She descended the stairs quickly and quietly in her bare feet. She followed Brett into the kitchen. He was dressed only in light blue pajama bottoms, their white cotton drawstring hanging down to below the neat fork of his crotch. Although it was barely midsummer, he was already very brown. He was naturally dark, like his father, and tanned easily. Standing in the doorway, she saw him in profile, that same fine, clear morning light pouring over his body, as he hunted along the line of cupboards above the stove and the counter and the sink. Her heart was full of wonder and fear. "He's beautiful," she thought. "Everything that's beautiful or ever was in us is in him." It was a moment she never forgot. She saw her son clad only in his pajama bottoms, and for a moment dimly comprehended the mystery of his boyhood, so soon to be left behind. Her mother's eyes loved the slim curve of his muscles, the line of his buttocks, the clean soles of his feet. He seemed utterly perfect. She saw it clearly because Brett wasn't awake. As a child, there had been episodes of sleepwalking, about 2 dozen of them in all, between the ages of 4 and 8. She had finally gotten worried enough, scared enough, to consult with Dr. Gresham, without Joe's knowledge. She wasn't afraid that Brett was losing his mind. Anyone who was around him could see he was bright and normal. But she was afraid that he might hurt himself while he was in that strange state. Dr. Gresham had told her that was very unlikely, and that most of the funny ideas people had about somnambulism came from cheap, badly researched movies. "We only know a little about sleepwalking," he had told her, "but we do know that it is more common in children than it is in adults.
There's a constantly growing, constantly maturing interaction between the mind and body, Mrs. Camber, and a lot of people who have done research in this field believe that sleepwalking may be a symptom of a temporary and not terribly significant imbalance between the two.
Like growing pains? She had asked doubtfully.
Very much like that, Gresham had said with a grin.
He drew a bell curve on his office pad, suggesting that Brett's somnambulism would reach a peak, hold for a while, then begin to taper off. Eventually, it would disappear. She had gone away a little reassured by the doctor's conviction that Brett would not go sleepwalking out a window or down the middle of a highway, but without being much enlightened. A week later, she had brought Brett in. He had been just a month or two past his 6th birthday then. Gresham had given him a complete physical and had pronounced him normal in every way. And indeed, Gresham had appeared to be right. The last of what Charity thought of as his night walks had occurred more than 2 years ago. The last, that was, until now. Brett opened the cupboards one by one, closing each neatly before going on to the next, disclosing Holly's casserole dishes, the extra elements to her Gen Air range, her dish towels neatly folded, her coffee and tea creamer, her as-yet-incomplete set of depression glassware. His eyes were wide and blank, and she felt a cool certainty that he was seeing the contents of other cabinets in another place. She felt the old helpless terror that she had almost completely forgotten, as parents do the alarms and the excursions of their children's early years, the teething, the vaccination that brought the frighteningly high fever as a little extra added attraction, the croup, the ear infection, the hand or leg that suddenly began to spray irrational blood. What's he thinking? She wondered. Where is he? And why now, after 2 quiet years? Was it being in a strange place? He hadn't seemed unduly upset, at least not until now. He opened the last cupboard and took down a pink gravy boat. He put it on the counter. He picked up empty air and mimed pouring something into the gravy boat. Her arms suddenly broke out in goose flesh as she realized where he was and what this dumb show was all about. It was a routine he went through each day at home. He was feeding Cujo. She took an involuntary step toward him and then stopped. She didn't believe those wives' tales about what might happen if you woke a sleepwalker, that the soul would be forever shut out of the body, that madness might result, or sudden death. And she hadn't needed Dr. Gresham to reassure her on that score. She had gotten a book on special loan from the Portland City Library. But she hadn't really needed that, either. Her own good common sense told her that what happened when you woke up a sleepwalker was that they woke up. No more and no less than just that. There might be tears, even mild hysteria, but that sort of reaction would be provoked by simple disorientation. Still, she had never wakened Brett during one of his night walks, and she didn't dare do so now. Good common sense was one thing. Her unreasoning fear was another, and she was suddenly very afraid and unable to think why. What could be so dreadful in Brett's acted-out dream of feeding his dog? It was perfectly natural, as worried as he had been about Cujo. He was bent over now, holding the gravy boat out, the drawstring of his pajama trousers making a right-angled white line to the horizontal plane of the red and black linoleum floor. His face went through a slow-motion pantomime of sorrow. He spoke then, muttering the words as sleepers so often do, gutturally, rapidly, almost unintelligibly, and with no emotion in the words themselves. That was all inside, held in the cocoon of whatever dream had been vivid enough to make him nightwalk again after 2 quiet years. There was nothing inherently melodramatic about the words, spoken all of a rush in a quick, sleeping sigh. But Charity's hand went to her throat anyway. The flesh there was cold. Cold. "Cujo's not hungry no more," Brett said, the words riding out on that sigh. He stood up again, now holding the gravy boat cradled to his chest. "Not no more, not no more." He stood immobile for a short time by the counter, and Charity did likewise by the kitchen door. A single tear had slipped down his face. He put the gravy boat on the counter and headed for the door. His eyes were open, but they slipped indifferently and unseeingly over his mother. He stopped, looking back. "Look in the weeds," he said to someone who was not there. Then he began to walk toward her again. She stood aside, her hand still pressed against her throat. He passed her quickly and noiselessly on his bare feet and was gone up the hall toward the stairs. She turned to follow him and remembered the gravy boat. It stood by itself on the bare, ready-for-the-day counter like the focal point in a weird painting. She picked it up and it slipped through her fingers. She hadn't realized that her fingers were slick with sweat. She juggled it briefly, imagining the crash in the still sleeping hours. Then she had it cradled safely in both hands. She put it back on the shelf and closed the cupboard door and could only stand there for a moment, listening to the heavy thud of her heart, feeling her strangeness in this kitchen. She was an intruder in this kitchen. Then she followed her son. She got to the doorway of his room just in time to see him climb into bed. He pulled the sheet up and rolled over on his left side, his usual sleeping position. Although she knew it was over now, Charity stood there yet a while longer. Somebody down the hall coughed, reminding her again that this was someone else's house. She felt a strong wave of homesickness. For a few moments, it was as if her stomach were full of some numbing gas, the kind of stuff dentists use. In this fine, still morning light, her thoughts of divorce seemed as immature and without regard for the realities as the thoughts of a child. It was easy for her to think such things here. It wasn't her house, not her place. Why had this pantomime of feeding Cujo and those rapid sighing words frightened her so much? Cujo's not hungry no more. Not no more. She went back to her own room and lay there in bed as the sun came up and brightened the room. At breakfast, Brett seemed no different than ever. He did not mention Cujo, and he had apparently forgotten about calling home, at least for the time being. After some interior debate, Charity decided to let the matter rest there. It was hot. Donna uncranked her window a little farther, about a quarter of the way, as far as she dared, and then leaned across Tad's lap to unroll his, too. That was when she noticed the creased yellow sheet of paper in his lap. "What's that, Tad?" He looked up at her. There were smudged brown circles under his eyes.
"The monster words," he said.
"Can I see?" He held them tightly for a moment and then let her take the paper. There was a watchful, almost proprietary expression on his face, and she felt an instant's jealousy. It was brief, but very strong. So far she had managed to keep him alive and unhurt, but it was Vic's hocus-pocus he cared about. Then the feeling dissipated into bewilderment, sadness, and self-disgust. It was she who had put him in this situation in the first place, if she hadn't given in to him about the babysitter.
"I put them in my pocket yesterday," he said, "before we went shopping. Mommy, is the monster going to eat us?"
"It's not a monster, Tad. It's just a dog. And no, it isn't going to eat us." She spoke more sharply than she had intended.
I told you, when the mailman comes, we can go home.
And I told him the car would start in just a little while, and I told him someone would come, that the Cambers would be home soon. But what was the use in thinking that?
May I have my monster words back? He asked.
For a moment, she felt a totally insane urge to tear the sweat-stained, creased sheet of yellow legal paper to bits and toss them out her window, so much fluttering confetti. Then she handed the paper back to Tad and ran both hands through her hair, ashamed and scared. What was happening to her, for Christ's sake? A sadistic thought like that? Why would she want to make it worse for him? Was it Vic? Herself? What? It was so hot. Too hot to think. Sweat was streaming down her face, and she could see it trickling down Tad's cheeks as well. His hair was plastered against his skull in unlovely chunks, and it looked two shades darker than its usual medium blonde. He needs his hair washed, she thought randomly. And that made her think of the bottle of Johnson's No More Tears again, sitting safely and sanely on the bathroom shelf, waiting for someone to take it down and pour a capful or two into one cupped palm. Don't lose control of yourself. No, of course not. She had no reason to lose control of herself. Everything was going to be all right, wasn't it? Of course it was. The dog wasn't even in sight, hadn't been for more than an hour. And the mailman? It was almost 10 o'clock now. The mailman would be along soon, and then it wouldn't matter that it was so hot in the car. The greenhouse effect, they called it. She had seen that on an SPCA handout somewhere, explaining why you shouldn't shut your dog up in your car for any length of time when it was hot like this. The greenhouse effect. The pamphlet had said that the temperature in a car that was parked in the sun could go as high as 140 degrees Fahrenheit if the windows were rolled up, so it was cruel and dangerous to lock up a pet while you did your shopping or went to see a movie. Donna uttered a short, cracked-sounding chuckle. The shoe certainly was on the other foot here, wasn't it? It was the dog that had the people locked up. Well, the mailman was coming. The mailman was coming, and that would end it. It wouldn't matter that they had only a quarter of a thermos of milk left, or that early this morning she had to go to the bathroom and she had used Tad's small thermos, or had tried to, and it had overflowed and now the pinto smelled of urine, an unpleasant smell that only seemed to grow stronger with the heat. She had capped the thermos and thrown it out the window. She had heard it shatter as it hit the gravel. Then she had cried. But none of it mattered. It was humiliating and demeaning to have to try and pee into a thermos bottle. Sure it was. But it didn't matter, because the mailman was coming. Even now he would be loading his small blue and white truck at the ivy-covered brick post office on Carbine Street. Or maybe he had already begun his route, working his way out Route 117 toward the Maple Sugar Road. Soon it would end. She would take Tad home, and they would go upstairs. They would strip and shower together. But before she got into the tub with him and under the shower, she would take that bottle of shampoo from the shelf and put the cap neatly on the edge of the sink, and she would wash first Tad's hair and then her own. Tad was reading the yellow paper again, his lips moving soundlessly. Not real reading, not the way he would be reading in a couple of years. If we get out of this, her traitorous mind insisted on adding senselessly but instantly, but the kind that came from rote memorization. The way driving schools prepared functional illiterates for the written part of the driver's exam. She had read that somewhere, too, or maybe seen it on a TV news story. And wasn't it amazing the amount of crud the human mind was capable of storing up? And wasn't it amazing how easily it all came spewing out when there was nothing else to engage it, like a subconscious garbage disposal running in reverse? That made her think of something that had happened in her parents' house, back when it had still been her house, too.
Less than 2 hours before one of her mother's famous cocktail parties, that was how Donna's father always referred to them, with a satirical tone that automatically conferred the capital letters, the same satirical tone that could sometimes drive Samantha into a frenzy. The disposal in the kitchen sink had somehow backed up into the bar sink, and when her mother turned the gadget on again in an effort to get rid of everything, green goo had exploded all over the ceiling. Donna had been about 14 at the time, and she remembered that her mother's utter hysterical rage had both frightened and sickened her. She had been sickened because her mother was throwing a tantrum in front of the people who loved and needed her most over the opinion of a group of casual acquaintances who were coming over to drink free booze and munch up a lot of free canapes. She had been frightened because she could see no logic in her mother's tantrum, and because of the expression she had seen in her father's eyes. It had been a kind of resigned disgust. That had been the first time she had really believed in her gut, that she was going to grow up and become a woman with at least a fighting chance to be a better woman than her own mother, who could get into such a frightening state over what was really such a little thing. She closed her eyes and tried to dismiss the whole train of thought, uneasy at the vivid emotions that memory called up. SPCA, greenhouse effect, garbage disposals. What next? How I lost my virginity? 6 well-loved vacations? The mailman! That was the thing to think about! The goddamn mailman!
Mommy, maybe the car will start now.
Honey, I'm scared to try it because the battery is so low.
But we're just sitting here, he said, sounding petulant and tired and cross. What does it matter if the battery's low or not if we're just sitting here? Try it!
Don't you go giving me orders, kiddo, or I'll whack your ass for you. He cringed away from her hoarse, angry voice, and she cursed herself again. He was scratchy, so who could blame him? Besides, he was right. That was what had really made her angry. But Tad didn't understand. The real reason she didn't want to try the engine again was because she was afraid it would bring the dog. She was afraid it would bring Cujo. And more than anything else, she didn't want that. Grimly, she turned the key in the ignition. The Pinto's engine cranked very slowly now, with a draggy, protesting sound. It coughed twice, but did not fire. She turned the key off and tapped the horn. It gave a foggy, low honk that probably didn't carry 50 yards, let alone to that house at the bottom of the hill. "There," she said briskly and cruelly. "Are you happy? Good." Tad began to cry. He began the way she always remembered it, beginning when he was a baby, his mouth drawing into a trembling bow, the tears spilling down his cheeks even before the first sobs came. She pulled him to her then, saying she was sorry, saying she didn't mean to be mean, it was just that she was upset too, telling him that it would be over as soon as the mailman got there, that she would take him home and wash his hair. And thought, a fighting chance to be a better woman than your mother. Sure, sure, kid. You're just like her. That's just the kind of thing she would have said in a situation like this. When you're feeling bad, what you do is spread the misery, share the wealth. Well, like mother, like daughter, right? And maybe when Tad grows up, he'll feel the same way about you as you feel about...
Why is it so hot, Mommy?
Tad asked dully. The greenhouse effect, she answered without even thinking about it. She wasn't up to this, and she knew it now. If this was, in any sense, a final examination on motherhood or on adulthood itself, then she was flagging the test. How long had they been stuck in this driveway?
15 hours at the very most, and she was cracking up, falling apart.
"Can I have a Dr. Pepper when we get home, Mommy?"
The monster words, sweaty and wrinkled, lay limply on his lap.
"All you can drink," she said, and hugged him tight.
But the feel of his body was frighteningly wooden.
"I shouldn't have shouted at him," she thought distractedly. "If only I hadn't shouted."
But she would do better, she promised herself, because the mailman would be along soon.
I think the doggie's going to eat us,
Tad said. She started to reply and then didn't. Cujo still wasn't around. The sound of the Pinto's engine turning over hadn't brought him. Maybe he was asleep. Maybe he had had a convulsion and died. That would be wonderful, especially if it had been a slow convulsion, a painful one. She looked at the back door again. It was so temptingly near. It was locked, she was sure of that now. When people went away, they locked up. It would be foolhardy to try for the door, especially with the mailman due so soon. Play it as though it were real, Vic sometimes said. She would have to, because it was real. Better to assume the dog was still alive and lying just inside those half-open garage doors, lying in the shade. The thought of the shade made her mouth water. It was almost 11 o'clock then. It was about 45 minutes later when she spotted something in the grass beyond the edge of the driveway on Tad's side of the car. Another 15 minutes of examination convinced her that it was an old baseball bat with a friction-taped handle, half obscured by witchgrass and timothy. A few minutes after that, just before noon, Cujo stumbled out of the barn, blinking his red rheumy eyes stupidly in the hot sun. Jerry Garcia's voice, easy but somehow weary, came floating down the hall, magnified and distorted by someone's transistor radio until it sounded as if the vocal were floating down a long steel tube. Closer by, someone was moaning. That morning, when he went down to the smelly industrial bathroom to shave and shower, there had been a puddle of vomit in one of the urinals and a large quantity of dried blood in one of the wash basins. Steve Kemp stood at the window of his room on the fifth floor of the Portland YMCA, looking down at Spring Street, feeling bad and not knowing why. His head was bad. He kept thinking about Donna Trenton and how he had fucked her over, and then hung around. Hung around for what? What the fuck had happened? He wished he were in Idaho. Idaho had been much on his mind lately. So why didn't he stop honking his donk and just go? He didn't know. He didn't like not knowing. He didn't like all these questions screwing up his head. Questions were counterproductive to a state of serenity, and serenity was necessary to the development of the artist. He had looked at himself this morning in one of the toothpaste-spotted mirrors and had thought he looked old. Really old. When he came back to his room, he had seen a cockroach zigzagging busily across the floor. The omens were bad.
"She didn't give me the brush because I'm old," he thought. "I'm not old. She did it because her itch was scratched, because she's a bitch, and because I gave her a spoonful of her own medicine. How did handsome hubby like his little love note, Donna? Did handsome hubby dig it?"
Did hubby get his little love note? Steve crushed his cigarette out in the jar top that served the room as an ashtray. That was really the central question, wasn't it? With that one answered, the answers to the other questions would drop into place. The hateful hold she had gotten over him by telling him to get lost before he was ready to end the affair. She had humiliated him, goddammit, for one thing. For one very big thing. Suddenly he knew what to do, and his heart began to thud heavily with anticipation. He put a hand into his pocket and jingled the change there. He went out. It was just past noon, and in Castle Rock, the mailman for whom Donna hoped had begun that part of his rounds which covered the Maple Sugar Road and Town Road Number 3. Vic, Roger, and Rob Martin spent Tuesday morning at Image Eye and then went out for beers and burgers. A few burgers and a great many beers later, Vic suddenly realized that he was drunker than he had ever been at a business luncheon in his life. Usually he had a single cocktail or a glass of white wine. He had seen too many good New York ad men drown themselves slowly in those dark places just off Madison Avenue, talking to their friends about campaigns they would never mount. Or, if they became drunk enough, to the barmen in those places about novels which they would assuredly never write. It was a strange occasion, half victory celebration, half wake. Rob had greeted their idea of a final sharp serial professor ad with tempered enthusiasm, saying that he could knock it a mile, always assuming he was given the chance. That was the wake half. Without the approval of old man Sharp and his fabled kid, the greatest spot in the world would do them no good. They would all be out on their asses. Under the circumstances, Vic supposed it was all right to get loaded. Now, as the main rush of the restaurant's lunchtime clientele came in, the three of them sat in their shirt sleeves at a corner booth, the remains of their burgers on waxed paper. Beer bottles scattered around the table, the ashtray overflowing. Vic was reminded of the day he and Roger had sat in the yellow sub back in Portland, discussing this little safari. Back when everything that had been wrong with the business. Incredibly, he felt a wave of nostalgia for that day, and wondered what Tad and Donna were doing.
"Going to call them tonight," he thought. "If I can stay sober enough to remember, that is." "So what now?" Rob asked. "You hanging out in Boston or going on to New York? I can get you guys tickets to the Boston-Kansas City series if you want them. Might cheer you up to watch George Brett knock a few holes in the left field wall."
Vic looked at Roger, who shrugged and said,
"On to New York, I guess. Thanks are in order, Rob, but I don't think either of us are in the mood for baseball."
"There's nothing more we can do here," Vic agreed. "We had a lot of time scheduled on this trip for brainstorming, but I guess we're all agreed to go with the final spot idea."
"There's still plenty of rough edges," Rob said. "Don't get too proud."
"We can mill off the rough edges," Roger said. "One day with the marketing people ought to do it, I think. You agree, Vic?"
"It might take two," Vic said.
"Still, there's no reason why we can't tie things up a lot earlier than we'd expected."
"Then what?"
Vic grinned bleakly.
"Then we call old man Sharp and make an appointment to see him. I imagine we'll end up going straight on to Cleveland from New York. The Magical Mystery Tour."
"See Cleveland and die," Roger said gloomily, and poured the remainder of his beer into his glass. "I just can't wait to see that old fart."
"Don't forget the young fart," Vic said, grinning a little.
"How could I forget that little prick?" Roger replied.
"Gentlemen, I propose another round."
Rob looked at his watch. "I really oughta..."
"One last round," Roger insisted. "Old Lang Syne, if you want."
Rob shrugged.
"Okay, but I still got a business to run, don't forget that. Although, without sharp cereals, there's going to be space for a lot of long lunches."
He raised his glass in the air and waggled it until a waiter saw him and nodded back.
"Tell me what you really think," Vic said to Rob. "No bullshit. You think it's a bust?"
Rob looked at him, seemed about to speak, then shook his head. Roger said,
"No, go ahead.
We're all set out to sea in the same pea-green boat, or red raspberry zingers carton, or whatever. You think it's no go, don't you?
I don't think there's a chance in hell, Rob said. You'll work up a good presentation, you always do. You'll get your background work done in New York, and I have a feeling that everything the market research boys can tell you on such short notice is all going to be in your favor.